New York.
All right, good.
Good morning. My name's Chris, and I'm an addict. Really grateful I'm still breathing. Can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Good, because I'm really not one of those people that likes screaming. And it's perfect that I'm short because the microphone's right here. I want to thank the convention committee for asking me to come out here and speak. It's an honor and a privilege. And this is a really, really awesome setting. I was walking down here from my hotel. I walked because I'm really not a morning person. So the walk from the Holiday Inn, which I think is like a mile or so away, you know, got the blood flowing, got me waking up a little bit. And there are two things that have been really, really important to me in my recovery. One of them is a beach meeting that I made when I first got clean, and the other is conventions. The very first convention I went to was in the area I got clean in, on Long Island, Suffolk area. And the first convention I ever went to was their first mini convention, and it was held at the New York Institute of Technology in Central Islip, New York. And I had about 9 months clean, and I was a door greeter, you know, so I got to hug everybody that came in. And I remember the main meeting that we had, it was about 350 people or something like that, and I was sitting on the lawn. And what I realized in that moment is that I was a part of something big and a part of something good. And it had been a really, really long time that I had been a part of something good. And it instilled in me a real excitement and an enthusiasm for recovery. And for all the years that I lived out in Suffolk area, I did lots of convention service, H&I service. I'm a big proponent of giving back. The fact is that everything I have that's of any worth in my life, I have because I've came to Narcotics Anonymous, because I've gotten clean, because I've been taught how to live like a human being, and I'm really, really grateful. And I think a great expression of gratitude is to give back to the fellowship, and so I try and do that any time that I can. As a result of coming to Narcotics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to use since October 2nd, 1998. Thank you. Clap for yourselves, because I didn't do this alone. Right now, I live in Roslyn, New York, which is kind of on the Nassau-Queens border. My home group is the Roslyn Men's Meeting. I am there all the time. You know, I'm a fixture in the meeting. I believe in attending my home group. God bless you. I believe in attending my home group each and every week. Bless you. And I was told early on there's one excuse for not making my home group, and that's a death. That death being my own. So that kind of resonated with me. There's a meeting out in Suffolk County on the beach at Smith Point Park, just called Footsteps in the Sand. And it's a step meeting, and it starts at 7 a.m., which for a guy like me is kind of tough. But if you got there at 7, you didn't have to pay for parking, you know? And I'm an addict. I like shit free. So I was always there by like 5 to 7. And that's where I first really started learning about the steps, you know, and really started learning how this stuff was gonna affect my life and change my life. I went and I stood by the water for a few minutes just to kind of focus on my breath and get centered, because every time I turned around, it was like more and more people here. I'm really glad this thing is working right now. And I don't cry all that often, but I was almost brought to tears because I started thinking about what my life was like prior to getting to Narcotics Anonymous. And here I am, you know, with the beach behind me, with the waves rolling, clean. Took a shower this morning. Actually had some food. Looked in my pocket. There was still money on a Saturday. Still money on a Saturday. And I just kind of really had this, you know, it's almost like this overwhelming wave of gratitude to the point that I almost was in tears. So when I say I'm grateful, I really, really mean it. And I always say I'm grateful I'm still breathing, because in active addiction, I did everything I could possible, you know, to not have to wake up on a Saturday morning. So the fact that I was able to wake up and not come to, the fact that it was in a king-size bed, not on a lawn somewhere, covered in my own piss and my own puke, is a real, real blessing. Because that's what using is to me. You know, there's no illusion for me now that there's any sort of party I'm missing. You know, inevitably I come to and puddles in my own piss and my own puke on the front lawn, never my front lawn. I didn't have to go down to the street corner and try and figure out what neighborhood I was in. These are all blessings that I have because I come here. When I was told I'm the only speaker and it's an hour-long meeting, I started to laugh. And the reason I started to laugh is somebody many years ago said, you know, Chris, there's other fellowships, there's Naranon and there's Al-Anon. You need to go to On and On and On. Here's the thing. Once I start getting I start talking about what Narcotics Anonymous has done for me, I can go on and on. You know, and it's not just blabbering, it's just this gratitude kind of wells out of me, you know. The fact that an addict like me can do this. If you're brand new and you're wondering, can I really do this? If an addict like me can do this, an addict like you can do this. Because there were addicts that were doing this prior to me getting here. There will be addicts doing this long after I'm gone. This program works. You know, I was told a long time ago that Narcotics Anonymous is like a big monkey wrench. It fits any nut that walks in the door. I'm one of the nuts. Good morning. All right, so a little bit about me. I want to preface by saying I'm going to tell you a little bit about my life, and then I want to talk about the steps and what the steps have done in my life. I don't blame anything that I have or anything that I've done or any decisions that I made on anybody else but myself, at least now. At the time when they were happening, it was everyone's fault but mine. What happened as a result of doing a fourth step and sitting down and going over that step and doing a fifth with my sponsor is I learned that my recurring pattern in active addiction and even in early recovery was that I don't take personal responsibility for anything. I literally had to be smacked upside the head for that to sink in, and I'll get to that when I talk about 4 and 5. But I was adopted at birth, which I, you know, as an addict, you know, one of the recurring themes you hear as addicts is that we felt different, or we felt out of place, we felt we didn't belong. So as a child who was adopted, I never felt like I really fit in. And it's not because I had a bad family. I had a mother who, she's like my best friend, you know, and if that makes me a mama's boy, I'm proud to be one. But she told me at a very early age, you're adopted, and what that means is that I chose you, and that you're special. And that's a beautiful thing to tell a child. But I'm an addict, and something that goes in this year kind of gets scrambled. And what I heard was, yes, I chose you, but if you're not a perfect little boy, I'm going to give you back. And that's not what my mom meant. But I'm an addict, that's what I heard. And I didn't realize I heard that until I did some step work. But it makes a lot of sense when I see some of the choices that I made in my life, that that's exactly how I interpreted it. She divorced the man that she adopted me with when I was like 2.5 years old. She remarried when I was about 4.5. And the man she married is the man I call Dad today, because I haven't seen her first husband since I'm 14 years old. Oddly enough, I started using at 14 years old. And I don't blame that on him. I believe that what I have, this disease that I have, has been waiting for many, many years. Because when I look back at my behavior prior to picking up the first one, self-centeredness was rampant through all of my behavior. So when my mother remarried, they both, you know, they had 2 kids, my brother and my sister, which are technically my adopted stepbrother and adopted stepsister, but they call me their brother. Today they're proud of me. That's close to my mind. And I hated the two of them because they were blood related to my parents and I wasn't. So I felt less than. And, how more self-centered can you get than just resenting somebody because they were born. So this disease was evident in my life long before I picked up the first drug. Fast forward many, many years. Well, actually, we'll just fast forward a few years. When I was in about fifth or sixth grade, I changed my last name. I had kept my mother's first husband's last name until I was in like fifth or sixth grade. And what happened was every time I'd come home with a permission slip for a field trip at school or something like that, and I'd have to have it signed, I'd have to explain why my last name wasn't the same as everybody else's in my house. So I changed it out of convenience. When I did an eighth step, and I actually put my mother's first husband, you know, let's say Frank. So this way, I don't have to keep saying first husband. When I did an eighth step, and I put Frank on the list, I put him on the list because what's the one thing that a father has to give their son but their last name? And I tossed that aside because it was just convenient to do so. So I haven't seen him, but he's on my eighth step list. And maybe sometime I'll bump into him. We had to move, when I was in sixth grade, we had to move out to Tucson, Arizona because my brother was deathly ill. Really, really bad asthma and allergies. And they said, either you put this kid in one of those bubbles, you move out to a climate like Arizona where it's dry and there's not a lot of pollen, or you make funeral arrangements. And so we packed up everything we had in a van, and we drove out to Tucson, Arizona from Long Island, New York. Today they would have locked my parents up, because we were in a cargo van, and right behind there was a driver's seat, the passenger seat, and a couch. And that's what the three of us sat on. Today that would be national news. My parents would have been on CNN. I would have been in foster care. But we were just fine. We went cross country on a couch. And everything we owned was behind us. You know, so boxes could have fallen on us and stuff. But we survived. So I hated everybody in my house because I had to pick up and leave. Again, it was all about me. This recurring theme, all about me. We spent a year out there. We came back to New York. Been back to New York since. And when I moved back to New York, I spent the summer with Frank. He dropped me off at the house at the end of the summer, and he said, I'll see you next week. Because he had weekend visitation. And that was the last time I saw him. Except the following week, I sat there looking out the bay window waiting for Frank to come and pick me up. And he didn't. To me, that was shortly thereafter is when I picked up for the first time. It's not Frank's fault. There was going to be a trigger at some point in my life that triggered this disease that was just waiting. It's not his fault I used. It was my inability to deal with my feelings, my unwillingness to deal with my feelings, my unwillingness to take personal responsibility for what I do, and I started using. And the first time I ever used, it was alcohol, and I put down 2/3 of a bottle of Johnny Walker Black. Well, back then I weighed a lot less than I do now. Actually, shit, almost 100 pounds. And so this was a Sunday night, and I drank that Sunday night, and I was drunk all day Monday, and hungover and throwing up all day Tuesday. Like the whole world was spinning faster than it normally does. Dry heaves, throwing up bile. And for most people, that would be an experience where they'd say, oh God, I'm never doing that again. But I'm an addict, and I was like, whee, when can we do that again? And I basically used like that for 14 straight years. You know, obviously there was a day or two here and there when I didn't use because I was passed out throughout the day or just didn't have any money that day and didn't have any ability to get any money that day. But for the most part, for the next 14 years, that's how I used. I had one active suicide attempt at the age of 17. I had cheated on a girl that I was absolutely head over heels in love with. If there's one that got away, it's her. Well, she didn't get away. I pushed her away. I have a habit of doing that. And I saw her kissing somebody else, and I came home, and I went into my family's medicine cabinet and just started grabbing pill bottles. And I had a big handful of pills, and a big bottle of Mountain Dew. And it took me like 7 minutes to swallow all of those pills. And I went down into my room and I expected to die. Where we were living at the time, we lived in a high ranch, and the downstairs had a den, which they converted into a bedroom for me. But in order to go into the laundry room, you had to go through that room. And my mother came through to do laundry, didn't bother pulling the shades up. Just as soon as she opened up the door, was struck by the smell. And says, oh my God, clean that up. So when she went into the laundry room, I turned the light on and quickly folded up my bed sheet. Because it was a navy blue bed sheet, and it was covered with the granules from all the capsules I had swallowed. And I didn't want my mother to see that. And so I kind of, you know, folded that all up, and after she was done, I washed it and went on like nothing happened. I'd love to tell you that that was the end of my road. That was at the age of 17, and I didn't get clean till 28. And it got a lot worse. Life got a lot worse. Fast forward to 1998. I wake up on a really, really sunny Monday morning. Well, it came to at like 9 o'clock. I was supposed to be in Queens at 7:15. So I got in my car. I started driving west, and I started thinking, what excuse am I going to use now? I've already had 7 grandmothers die. I can't use that one. And I ran through all of these scenarios in my head, and I realized I didn't have an excuse. And I had what I didn't know at the time, or I found out later when I came to Narcotics Anonymous, is I had a moment of clarity when I realized that I had become a homeless, drunken crackhead, and I had no idea when that happened. That realization hit me like a brick. And so I was on the Long Island Expressway, and I got off at exit 58, and I went to my mother's house. Now, there's no logical reason why my mom should have been home at that time in the morning, but she was. So I knocked on the door. I had to knock. I didn't have a key anymore. And she opened up the door, and with that, like, ESP that moms have, she opened up the door and said, what's wrong? And I just said, can I come in? So I came in, and I just stood there. She said, what's wrong? I just started sobbing. Now, I've cried numerous times in my life. That was the only time I ever sobbed. And my legs gave out from under me. And there I am, in my mother's arms, at 28 years old. And she says, what's wrong? Are you hurt? Are you hurt? And all that came out of my mouth was, I can't do this anymore. And it was almost like I had to turn around and see who the hell said that. Because I didn't come to that morning saying, oh, I can't do this anymore. So I called my job. I called the employee assistance program of my job. And spoke to this counselor. I'd gone to see this guy like 6 months prior. Basically because I was in trouble at work. A name like Railroad Chris, you can figure out what I do for a living. My company runs on a schedule. They're really not interested in you showing up late. Yet that didn't stop me from showing up late all the time. With the attitude of, you're lucky I'm here at all. Don't you know who I am? I guess people can relate. You're laughing. So I called, when I had gone to see this guy 6 months prior to try and save my job, he says, so why are you here? I said, I have insomnia. He says, what do you mean you have insomnia? I says, I'm up till 3, 4 o'clock every morning. I can't get to sleep. I'm waking up late. It's causing a lot of problems on my job. You got to send me for one of those sleep studies. And he looked at me and he goes, sleep studies? Yeah, I'll look into that for you. And I never heard back from him. So when I called him this particular morning, he says, I've been waiting for your call. And I thought, that was kind of fucked up. You were supposed to get back to me. So he says, you know, what can I do for you? I told him I can't stop using. Again, wanted to look behind. Who the hell said that? I didn't wake up thinking I had a problem with drugs. I didn't wake up thinking that, you know, that I couldn't do this anymore. I woke up thinking I needed an excuse for my job. I And he said, well, what do you want to do? I says, if you don't get me some help, I'm going to wind up dead again. The fuck is saying this? And he said, where are you? I said, at my mother's. He says, that's a good place for you. Give me the number. I gave him a number. He called me back. He says, call this number. So I called the number, and it was a rehab facility on the eastern end of Long Island. And so I called them up, and they said, when can you get out here? I said, for what? They said, you're going to come stay with us for a while. I said, oh, I could probably be there this afternoon. They said, good, we'll see you this afternoon. So I hop in the car with my mother. We go to where I was staying. I was squatting in a friend of mine's camping trailer in front of his house. So I went and grabbed everything and put it in my luggage. At the time, my luggage was made by Hefty. I threw some clothes and stuff in there. And I went. And that was a Monday morning. On Tuesday, they had a Narcotics Anonymous meeting in that facility. And it was the first time I raised my hand and said, my name's Chris and I'm an addict. I had no idea what was going on. At the time, I was drinking ridiculous amounts of alcohol every day. They had me on some anti-seizure medication. They put me in an observation room with a big glass window. So I got people watching me sleep. I'm an addict. I got trust issues. I don't want people watching me sleep. And so the very, very first speaker I heard in Narcotics Anonymous, the very first thing he said was, just for today, you never have to use again. And that sounded like some really important stuff he was telling me. And it seems like a really simple enough sentence. All right, just for today. We do this just for today. There's a reading just for today. There's a book just for today. It's a just for today program. I get that. It was that second part that I didn't get until I got out of rehab. That the whole you never have to use again. Because if you're anything like me, if you used anything like me, your identity was wrapped in using. I can tell you that mine was. You know, I ran with a rough crowd, yet I didn't have the luxury of being able to point to somebody and say, well, at least I'm not as bad as him. I was that example for other people, you know? Nobody I hung out with had a problem because, well, no, Chris has a problem. That guy's fucked up. I just drink. So I didn't have that luxury, you know? But I just thought I was, you know, this crazy party animal, you know, fun guy, made everybody laugh and kept everybody awake because I didn't feel like using the loan, at least earlier in recovery, towards the end. I didn't want anybody near me. You know, I wanted to smoke my shit, your shit, somebody else's shit. I wanted to steal that guy's shit. So I never looked at it as having to use. But once I understood that active addiction for me was having to use, and there was somebody telling me, you don't ever have to do that again, that's when the light bulb went off. And that was the beginning of me understanding that I could live a life without drugs. Because I didn't really know if I could do this. So I started making meetings. If there's anything I did right in my first year, was I made lots and lots of meetings. I probably made well over 600 meetings in my first year clean. If you're brand new, I'm not telling you you have to go to 600 meetings. I'm telling you that I was in such bad shape, I shouldn't have been allowed out of the house without adult supervision. Okay. So I made lots and lots of meetings. I raised my hand a lot. It wasn't a lot of good that came out of my mouth, but I raised my hand a lot. They told me to get a sponsor, so I was at a group, and there was a guy that celebrated his first year clean, and I thought I was going to do him a favor and be his first sponsee. So I went up to him, and I says, look, you know, you have a year clean now, I really need a sponsor. And he looked at me, and he says, look, I'm really kind of learning about this myself right now. I don't feel like, you know, that I could guide somebody else through the program. I thought to myself, didn't they say the newcomer is the most important person in any meeting? But I thought to myself, well, if this guy really feels he can't help me, then maybe it's a good thing he said no. So I asked another guy. There was another guy. Every time I got to a meeting, he was already there. I used to joke with him that he was following me from the front. So I says, I should ask this guy. He's real easy to find. And so I asked him. And he started laughing, which I thought was fucked up. And he said, don't take this the wrong way. Anytime somebody tells you, don't take this the wrong way, there's nothing good that's going to come out of their mouth. He said, don't take this the wrong way, but you're going to require a lot of time. And I've got too many sponsees as it is. And I said, okay. Again, isn't the newcomer the most important person in any meeting? So I did something that my current sponsor talks about, and it's, I'll show you, I'll hurt me. I have this pattern of when somebody hurts me, rather than deal with that hurt, I hurt myself worse. Because quite frankly, I'm a lot better at it than you are. I've got a lot more practice fucking me over than you do. And so what I did was I made lots and lots of meetings and raised my hand and said, my name's Chris, I'm an addict, and the newcomer is not the most important person at any meeting. I've asked two of you to sponsor me. Both of you turned me down. I'll do this without a sponsor. I'm going to be that guy. And I hated you people. You were all too fucking happy. You were all laughing. You know, I was here a red hot minute, but I was convinced you were laughing at me. And people would say, keep coming back. And I thought you were trying that reverse psychology shit on me. So I kept coming back out of spite. Whatever gets you to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting gets you to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. There's no wrong reasons to get to NA. Because even if you're coming here just because you're looking to get laid, you're looking to rob somebody, you're looking to sell drugs in the parking lot, the fact is that if you stick around Narcotics Anonymous long enough, that seed's going to get planted. And that seed will grow without your permission. So I was in you know, and I literally would say, you can all go fuck yourselves. And people hugged me. People took me to the diner. And I was on one of those rants and raves one night. Now, I'm 5'6 with my shoes on. This short little fucker sitting next to me. I'm like, I'm not getting a sponsor. And he looks at me, he goes, you don't have a sponsor yet? I says, no, why? You looking for a fucking job? And he said, yes, I am. Here's my number. Start calling me every day. And God rest his soul, one of my best friends at the time, Basic Bob, who's no longer with us, looked at me and said, Chris, what's the matter? And I was like, I think I just got a sponsor. And I started doing weird shit, like calling him every day, telling him what was going on, telling him, you don't understand, you don't know who I am. He said, there are two people on the phone right now, and one of them doesn't know who you are, and it's not me. And I hated him. You know why? He was going to tell me the truth whether I liked it or not. Because he understood this program. He understood that the disease I had wanted me dead. And he was going to be honest with me whether I decided I was going to love him or not. And as much as I hated him, I kept calling him. And then he just, like, disappeared. Like, literally. Like, I couldn't find him. Nobody could find him. And I wound up asking another guy to sponsor me who, when we sat down to go over some step work, I realized that he was far sicker than I gave him credit for. And that's a lot coming from me. And I was at a Saturday night meeting and I heard a guy speak. And I did what you told me not to do. You know, they tell me to identify with the feelings, don't compare the story. Of course, I'm an addict. I do the exact opposite. And I compared my story to his. And as bad as my story was, because I lived my story, his sounded like so much worse. Yet he seemed comfortable in his own skin. And I remember literally saying to myself, God, it'd be nice to know what that feels like. And so I asked him to sponsor me. He told me years later that he used to avoid me. He was like, you were too crazy for me. Because I would throw an occasional chair and punch an occasional wall. And all of that yelling and screaming and cursing was me telling you that I was scared. without having an ability to tell you I was scared. And the beautiful thing about Narcotics Anonymous is people saw through that and embraced me and held me and kept me here. So I started working with that sponsor. I was in the middle of a fourth step, and I hadn't written in a while. He was like, you need to start writing again, and I did. I was not very thorough in my fourth step. We were really thorough in my fifth step. I was so scared. I had uncovered in writing, I had uncovered some pain that I ran from for 14 years of active addiction. And here's my experience. My experience is, for me, there is no escaping a feeling. I can run from it, I can numb myself, I can avoid feeling it. At some point in time, that feeling will insist on being felt. And 14 years of active addiction, I didn't really feel. Here I was, you know, in about 9 months clean, with nothing to numb me, feeling all those feelings I ran from, and they hit me like a train. And I didn't know what to do with all of that. So there were, you know, and I did it at the step working guide had just come out, and for anybody that's ever opened up that book, there's some pretty thorough freaking questions in there. And there were some times where I answered with a fragmented sentence, or just a yes, or a no.
Sure. NA is non-smoking. We have people with asthma, bronchitis. Put your cigarettes out, please.
So what happened is, when I did, when we sat down to do a fifth step, it took us 16 hours. We met one Friday for 8 hours, and then my sponsor went away on vacation. And all I was thinking was, he's not coming back. He'd gone out of the country. I'm like, he's moving there. All about me again. And as soon as he came back, he called me and he says, when are we going to get together? And I said, for what? He goes, to finish your step. And I told him where my mind had gone. And he goes, no, of course we're getting together. And when I came to his house, he opened up the door, I stepped in, and he embraced me for what, for me, was a really uncomfortable length of time. Because I really just wasn't used to being, you know, there was no mistaking that there was just pure love coming from that man. And I didn't know how to deal with that. But at the same time, there was this overwhelming sense of peace that somehow everything was going to be okay. And it had been a really, really, really long time since I had felt that everything was going to be okay. That man's still my sponsor today, by the way. We're both still clean. And I continue to work all the steps. And I'm going to run through my understanding of what the steps are and what they mean to me. Step one, for me, powerlessness is all about the fact that I'm just not built like other people. I'm married to a woman who's not an addict. We had been dating for a year before she would have a glass of wine in front of me. So we're out, we're having dinner, we're having a nice meal at a restaurant around the corner from our house. She has a glass of white wine. We get the bill, you know, we get dessert, we get the bill. She's like, okay, we can go. She had about a third of a glass of wine left. I says, there's no reason for us to rush. We can finish your wine. She goes, no, I'm good. I says, honey, we're just going home. It's around the corner. We have no appointments or anything. You can finish your wine. She's like, no, I'm good. I went to say something else. She was like, I'm done with the fucking wine. Can we go home? That doesn't make sense to me. I not only want to finish what's in the glass, I want to take a laser, I want to cut the glass in half, I want to lick the inside of it just in case there's wine molecules left. What do you mean you're leaving some in the glass? What the hell is wrong with you? That she can do that. I can't. I wake up in puddles of my own piss and my own puke. I'm no longer drinking good wine, you know. So that's what step one is for me. The whole idea of powerlessness is that I am not built like other people. Obviously, I'm not built like my wife. But I'm just not built like other people that can just go and use a little. Save some for tomorrow. What? What? As long as I continue to accept that and keep that up front, I have an ability to live a really, really beautiful life. Step two is all about one word for me, and that's maybe. Maybe I can do this. Maybe there's a power greater than myself. Maybe I can be restored to sanity. I don't know about restored. I don't know that I was ever really sane. But for me, that restoration to sanity is my thinking and the decisions that I make. I make much more sane decisions. Whether I'm sane or not, my friend Kaj is here. He probably would tell you no. I would probably have to agree with him. But the decisions I make today are a lot more sane. Step three for me, turning my will and my life over to the care of, is much like when I bring my car to a mechanic. I'm not a mechanic. I don't know much about my car. But when I bring it to the mechanic, I get it back. It's in better condition than it was. You know, that mechanic cares for my car. It's not his car. It's still my car. I'm responsible for it. I got to put gas in it. You know, I got to insure it. But when I bring it to him, he tells me, well, this is what was wrong, and I fixed this. And there's, to me, it's that back and forth thing that, you know, that by the time I get to the 11th step, I've learned so much about it, and I care so much because I've been cared for, that you don't know whether my mechanics had the car or I've had the car. The car's running smoothly. That may not make sense to you, but it makes sense to me. Step four was really just talking about stuff that already happened. You know, when I had put that step down, I was sharing about it in meetings, and a guy came up to me and he says, did you die when any of that stuff happened? I said, no. He goes, then you ain't going to die if you put it on paper. So just write about it. Yeah. You ain't kidding. Step five for me was when I really, really developed faith in this program, because I told my sponsors some things that I had never told another human being. And they didn't get all over, you know, the NA gossip line, you know. I told him stuff that I thought made me lower than whale shit, and he hugged me and told me he loved me. Step six, the way I got entirely ready was I acted on every defect that I could identify. I got to a place where I was in so much pain that I had no choice but to humbly ask to have this shit removed. I followed that. In my area, one of the suggestions they give is try not to get yourself into a relationship in the first year. Which it's a pretty sound suggestion. Because every relationship I had been in prior to that was literally a train wreck. And so I was a good addict. I didn't even kiss a woman in my first year clean. Not because I didn't want to. Just because I realized, well, if I make such a mess of things, maybe I should learn a little about myself before I get involved with somebody again. It's like a good addict at day 366. There's a woman sharing in a meeting how she's just really going through a hard time. And I'm a good addict. I want to be supportive. So I says, would you like to talk about this out in the parking lot after the meeting? She said, sure. And so we talked. We actually went across the street to the diner and had a cup of coffee. I walked her out to her car. I gave her a hug. The hug became an hour-long kiss. And we had a two-month relationship, which was probably 6 weeks longer than it should have been. Because what had happened was, she had 9 years clean, I had a year clean. So if we were hanging out naked on the couch, mentioning a spiritual principle here and there, that was a meeting. I stopped calling my sponsor because, hell, she's got more time than he does. I'll bounce it off of her. And the biggest problem with our relationship is I couldn't fit her into a stem. She became a drug to me. Every time she said, I love you, I felt like it was going to make up for every time I hadn't heard that in my life. What I did was I smothered her. And I told my sponsor, you know, during my fifth step, I felt like I had all these abandonment issues. You know, and I said to him, I was like, look, there's another one that left. And he goes, she didn't leave, she fled. What the fuck do you mean she fled? What kind of thing is that to say? He said, you created an atmosphere that was so suffocating, she had no choice but to run in the opposite direction from you as far and as fast as she could. He said, are you really ready to do this now? I said, yes. Now I understand why I need to have these things removed. My belief is, defects or short, you can call them whatever you want. I know some people think the defect is one thing and the shortcoming is another. And I'm not saying you're wrong, but from my understanding, if I go to the doctor and I have a problem with my appendix and I'm entirely ready to have that appendix removed, I don't want him taking out my spleen. I just want to, look, character defects are short, or literature says character defects or shortcomings are things that could cause pain and misery all of our lives. I just wanted them gone. So I asked for them to be gone. Step 8's my favorite step. Because what happened in step 8 when I was writing that list of people that I owed amends to, it was the first time where I was really taking personal responsibility for what I had done. And there was such freedom in being able to do that. You know, my sponsor literally, when I went through all of my resentments in my fourth step, he says, what's the common denominator in all of those? You know, I was like, people leave me. He's like, no, it's you. You were involved in all of those things. What was your part? Because I missed that when I was writing. I missed that I was supposed to be focusing on my part. Step 9 almost was like, because step 8 was like my white light moment, step 9 was almost a letdown. I mean, I made amends, and I made mostly to my family, you know, and various financial institutions that I owed money to, and just decided at one point in time that I didn't really like paying bills, so I stopped. And to myself, you know, that's probably the longest ongoing amend I have. 10 was beautiful because I could focus on today. You know, I had gotten rid of enough wreckage that I could focus on today. 11, I kind of read like every piece of spiritual literature I could find, trying to find my own way and my own belief. And I don't know that I could really explain to you fully what my higher power is. I just know I have one, you know, and I know it's been working so far. And 12 is doing this and anything else I'm asked to do for Narcotics Anonymous. And the reason I have to go through that is because, and I need to continue to practice that, is because if I don't, I work the steps in reverse. In 12, I stopped giving back. I stopped doing anything for Narcotics Anonymous. In 11, I stopped praying and meditating. In 10, I stopped taking a daily inventory. In 9, I start believing that you owe me an amends. Not only do you owe me an amends, but a lot of you do, so I need to make a list of how many of you owe me an amends. In 7 and 6, I say, I don't have any defects. You people are the ones that have fucked up. In 5, I stop telling anybody anything that's going on. In 4, I start taking everybody else's inventory. In 3, yeah, my will and my life, yeah, they're fucking mine, so I'm going to do what I want to do with them. In 2, I get back to making really, really insane decisions. And in 1, I look around the room and go, you people can't fucking help me. There's no power here. Now, that could take a really long time to happen or a really short period of time to happen. But if I'm not actively involved in this and trying to practice this, that's what's going to happen to me. I'm going to work the steps in reverse, and then I'm going to use. You know, yeah, I'm clean like 16 and a half years, but I'm not immune. You know, I got a bunch of sponsees that call me all the time. I'm not immune. I get opportunities to speak at events like this. I'm not immune. I'm never, ever immune, because I ain't built like my wife. You know, when somebody says, would you like a glass of wine, I pull the cork out with my teeth and say, it's already in a glass. I'm good. That's me. That's always going to be me. It doesn't matter how many meetings I make, how many times I pray, how many blessings I have in my life. I have the capacity to become that homeless, drunken crackhead covered in his own piss and his own puke. Narcotics Anonymous allows me not only to not do that, but have this new way to live, to become this person that people respect, to be this person that my brother and sister brag about. My mom gave me the best compliment anybody's ever given me in my life. I was really, really, really good in school until I started picking up straight A's, skipping grades, who's who of American students, honor roll, advanced classes, all this stuff. I had plans to become a doctor. I'm not a doctor, I'm a laborer. I make a really good living as a laborer, but I'm a laborer. And my mom had all these dreams for me. But about 5 years ago, she said to me, you know, I just want you to know, you became the man I always knew you could be. And it's only because I come here. Thank you. All of you. Because I don't do this alone. I don't know how to do any of this. You know, I continue to look for guidance from my sponsor. I continue to need meetings. You know, I don't, just because I got 16 and a half years, don't mean I just come here because I'm here to help somebody. I need fucking help. I need a lot of help. You know, somebody said act your age. I said, I don't want to act my age. I've never been this age before. I love Narcotics Anonymous. I know they might have been concerned, can the guy speak this long, but I actually didn't say everything I wanted to. I want to tell all of you thank you. I want to tell all of you that I love you. Some of you are just best friends I haven't met yet. If there are steps and traditions hanging on the wall, if somebody read them, I am home. You know, I'm hours away from home, but at the same time, I am home, right here. How fucking awesome is this? I'm overwhelmed with gratitude. My name's Chris. I'm an addict. Thanks for letting me share.